Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Oh, and now to this studio. This is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service. Telecom 1987, a personal reflection on the world's largest telecommunications show on Earth. From Geneva, Switzerland, here's Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and I thought it fitting to use a traditional Swiss musical box from the museum here in Geneva, built in the same year, 1865, that saw the foundation of the International Telecommunication Union. Actually, it was the Telegraph Union back in those early days. This intergovernmental body was set up to try and regulate the airwaves, for if everyone who wanted to communicate simply picked any old spot on the dial, we'd end up with instant chaos. The ITU has been fairly successful in organising regular conferences so that users of the electromagnetic spectrum can discuss their requirements and keep to certain allotted frequencies. The problem now, 122 years after the ITU was founded, is that the spectrum space is rapidly filling up, and politics as well as technical considerations is playing an ever-increasing role in the discussions. Meanwhile, to give you a light-hearted analogy, if aviation had developed as fast as information technology is doing at the moment, then, comparatively speaking, the Wright brothers would have left on their maiden voyage just 3 weeks ago. Just as home computer owners have worried about whether the computer they buy today will be obsolete as soon as they get it home, so many of the professionals are concerned about the latest multi-million dollar digital telephone exchanges, which are only designed to last about 8 years. Digital technology will mean that job descriptions in the industry will change, manual labour shrinks to a minimum, those with qualified knowledge of soft and hardware problems are suddenly in demand. Well, now, the ITU Telecom is held every 4 years, and when the doors closed on Tuesday the 27th of October, I was told the total number of visitors was near the 70,000 mark. 53,500 square metres of floor space is rather difficult to describe, except to say that it took me 3 days just to walk round and orientate myself, and another 3 to find the people to interview for this programme. Bearing in mind that 1 square metre of exhibition space costs $156, some incredible sums of money have been spent. One American computer giant spent $25 million to build an incredible stand and supply all the computers. It's being sold, in fact, to the Geneva PAL Expo Exhibition Centre for a token $5 because it's too expensive to dismantle. Last Thursday, though, the stand from Wang Computers started to collapse literally under its own weight, and technicians worked through the night to conceal blue-painted iron posts to prop it up again. Monday, October 19th, was designated the press day, and some 700 journalists turned up to find that only half the stands were actually complete. I went to one multinational stand, whereupon a loud voice over a tannoy told me to go away. At least, that was the gist of the message. So I joined my colleagues for the press conference by ITU Secretary-General Richard Butler in Conference Room D. Mr. Butler began his address, and we listened intently on the headphones. And this is what we heard. Yes, a technical hitch meant that the entire speech was drowned out by a test tone. Many journalists left the opening ceremony with an empty notepad, somewhat saddened that the spokesman for such an important telecommunications organisation clearly finds it difficult to communicate clear, concise pictures of where the industry is going. So we escaped to the exhibition itself.
Thank you for calling the 24 Hours Bookstore. Please enter the service code using your touchtone phone. We are ready to take your order. Please enter your member number.
These days in Japan and the United States, you can phone an intelligent computer that will ask you questions or take an order, and you can respond by pressing one or more keys on the keypad of the telephone. One shortwave listener group in America, the DX Newsline, is already using this to help hobbyists exchange news about developments on the international broadcast bands. And the message of Telecom 87 has been that there are more uses for the phone just round the corner. Just as a compact disc stores the sound of a musical instrument or the human voice as a very fast series of zeros and ones, so it's possible for digital telephone exchanges to convert speech into a digital form and make a very much more efficient job of getting the message safely to the other end. By the 1990s, many parts of Western Europe, including Holland, will see the introduction of a new telephone socket in the wall. Not only will you be able to talk to someone, but at the same time send him or her a computer program, perhaps. And in 15 to 20 years from now, the capacity of the line may be great enough to distribute TV pictures and programs through that single point in the home. Mind you, manufacturers of broadcast transmitters don't agree with that theory, because they'll be out of business. Predicting anything, in fact, in the telecommunications world is dangerous. By the year 2000, our present scientific knowledge will have doubled, but politicians and administrators won't be able to double their speed of decision-making. As a radio listener visiting Telecom 87, you couldn't miss the broadcaster's pavilion by the front entrance. Eight international broadcasters were represented, providing a refreshing reminder that shortwave radio isn't out of date at all. BBC, Voice of America and Deutsche Welle each had separate stands, whilst Radio Australia, Swiss Radio International, Radio Sweden, Radio Canada International and Radio Netherlands pooled resources to build a joint one. Whilst some visitors headed straight for the stand for the latest news on the stock market plummet, two people manning the Sony stand at the Broadcast Pavilion entrance were drawing interest with two new shortwave radios. Chris Walden of Sony explained them to me.
OK, well, the smallest one has the tentative name of the Shortwave 1, and it's basically the same as the 7600D, which is well established. The only thing about this particular set is that it's the size of a cigarette packet. Well, not only that, it has stereo FM, and this is something that travellers have long asked for, and we're now providing it. I guess you could call this executive radio.
And what sort of price?
Very hard to say exactly, because the product is actually due for launch around next summer, but we're looking around the £200 sterling mark. But that includes a full kit, including power supply, antenna, headphones, etc.
And what sort of antenna will be supplied with it? Because I noticed there's a telescopic antenna, which very conveniently collapses into the cigarette-size radio.
Well, that's right. It does have a loudspeaker in the front, of course, so if you're just using it on the loudspeaker, then you would require the telescopic antenna. But when you slip the device into your pocket, the headphones actually become the antenna, so you can conceal it very nicely and listen to stereo FM music on your travels, which is rather nice.
Performance of the SW1 is indeed similar to the existing 7600D, known in some parts of the world as the 2002, but there's no provision for single sideband reception, nor can you fine-tune on the shortwave bands between the fixed 5 kHz steps. But seeing something so small cover 100 kHz right up to 30 MHz continuously, offering digital readout, keypad tuning, and reasonable audio for its size, was indeed quite a world premiere. The other transportable radio next to it was churning out weather maps printed on thermal paper. What was this then?
It's the all-singing, all-dancing WeatherFax receiver, which is tentatively called the V21. This receiver will pick up either the geostationary satellites or the orbital satellites, as well as covering the regular HF band from 9 kHz to 30 MHz. It's an all-mode receiver. It will pick up fax, RTTY, wideband FM, narrowband FM, wide and narrow AM, single sideband. It has synchronous detectors, has its own facsimile printer built into it. But one of the most interesting things of all is the spectrum analyzer display.
Now, how does that work? How would you use it?
Right, well, let's take the FM band as a prime example. I would select, say, a 5 MHz area, let's say from 85 MHz to 90 MHz. Select that on the spectrum analyzer, and it actually analyzes the signals that are in the local area. So to tune in, you just turn the dial, line up a cursor, and there you are. So you can actually look and see the signal strength of the signals around you.
So you've got a liquid crystal display with a sort of graph in front of you showing who's on the air.
Exactly. This is something that cost a fortune in the commercial world. Spectrum analyzers cost in excess of £6,000, and here it is, built into a receiver to aid tuning. It's a marvellous idea.
Does it also work on shortwave? Because you've taken a VHF example there of 5 megahertz. That's rather large for shortwave.
Yes, of course it does. You can select a band scan of 200 kilohertz, 1 megahertz, or 5 megahertz. So it's suitable for use on any of the frequencies that this receiver operates on.
And when's that going to be available?
Again, that's going to be available next summer.
And what sort of price?
Well, again, we have to be tentative here. The receiver itself, including the facsimile printer, which is integral to the unit, should be around the £2,500 mark, but complete with geostationary satellite antenna and down converter, the whole package is going to be about £4,000. So we're aiming at the sort of embassy market, the news agencies like Reuters, etc., and even farmers who need the very latest up-to-date weather information prior to gathering their harvest. So we see lots of applications, including marine, of course, very important.
The Alternative Telecom Report, 1987.
By 5 p.m. on each day of the fair, the roads in Geneva came to a standstill as everyone tried to get back to the hotel or head for one of the many receptions being held. Most companies had to book and pay for restaurants 3 years in advance to be sure of success. The American Bell South Company hired a steamboat on Lake Geneva and entertained its guests on board with a New Orleans jazz band. As the wine flowed, so did the information.
Attention pour décompte final.
Final countdown.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5.
Whereas digital telephone exchanges will take decades to have a full impact here in Europe, proper direct satellite TV programs are literally weeks away. On November 17th, the European Ariane rocket is scheduled to launch the German TV set. Assuming all goes well, I asked Rolf Vanham, who's managing director of Eurosatellite, when the transmissions will start.
I think that the Deutsche Bundespost, who owns the satellite, will put first programming on the satellite by about Christmas of this year. But this is still for test purposes. I think the operational lifetime of the satellite will start at the beginning of March, end of February, beginning of March.
Now, what sort of equipment do people need? Because up till now, there have been satellites. There are satellites up there already broadcasting programs, but these are communication satellites.
First of all, and in general, you need very simple and small equipment. That comprises an outdoor unit, which is a parabolic dish. This parabolic dish will have a first amplifier. We call that low-noise block converter or something like that. And if you have a new television set, which is already to receive satellite signals, then you need nothing in between. Would you have an old television set, then you need a converter, which converts down the high frequencies of the satellite into the nominal and normal frequencies of our two-day terrestrial transmission system.
Now, what will the standard be used for broadcasting? We've got PAL and SECAM right across Europe, but will there be a different standard used on the satellite?
The satellite by itself is not concerned by any question of that standard. We can use PAL, we can use SECAM, we can use the new D2 MAC. The Deutsche Bundespost is presently insisting on using D2 MAC, but of course the situation will be a little bit different if there are no D2 MAC receivers available, and it looks like we have yet not any D2 MAC receiver in the shops.
But that's something you can control from the ground, is it?
Yes, you just use whatever you decide to uplink the signal, and the satellite will transmit it downlink in the same format you go up with.
There are 4 channels on board TVSat, although between 01 and 17 hours UTC each day, one of those channels will be used for digital radio, 16 programs at the same time, in fact. At the West German company of FUBA, I ran across Neil Schiffhauer, the company's public relations director. Pointing to a satellite radio tuner on display, I wanted to know how much one will cost in a few months' time.
It's a very easy question, but a difficult answer, because there is, up to now, no market for that. I would presume that the cost would be about 1,500 to 2,000 Deutschmark.
Which is indeed roughly about the price of a colour television.
That's right.
But that $900 digital radio won't work during the evenings at present. The transponder's being used for television instead. Although the main audience is, of course, West Germany, the signal spillover for TVSAT will be huge. You'll need just a 70-centimetre dish if you want to receive it in Stockholm, Warsaw or London, as small as a 40-centimetre dish if you live closer to Germany. Of course, the programmes, though, will be in the German language. TVSAT has a French counterpart called TDF1, due to go up next year after a lot of delay. Eurosatellite, the company that built both of them, says it's not worried by the Luxembourg-based Astra Satellite Corporation, the competition. Astra will offer 16 TV channels from one satellite, but at a lower power for each channel. That means a large dish of some 90 centimetres for the consumer. But since TVSAT is the first in line, will there be any charge for the programmes?
All the channels on the German TVSAT will be free to receive, no cost. It's just an extra gadget. The equipment you need for reception may cost around 1,500 Deutschmarks if you only receive TVSAT. If you desire to receive with the same equipment, TDF, the upcoming French satellite, then it will be probably 2,000 marks, but you get for this extra 500 another four channels in French programming.
Why that extra cost?
The two satellites, TVSAT and TDF satellites, will be exactly positioned in the same orbital slot, so you use the same antenna, but the German satellite is transmitting in one polarization and the French satellite in another polarization, and therefore you need a second low-noise block converter in the antenna, which costs about 500 Deutschmarks.
This may sound like a silly question, but is there no danger that the two might collide if they're that close together?
Not at all. The cubic in which the two satellites will be anchored are 75 by 75 by 75 kilometers, and I think we can arrange that they are a couple of kilometers away.
And how long are the satellites scheduled to last?
The lifetime of the satellites is at least 9 years. Our experience says that we probably can operate them 1.5 or twice as long as the 9 years sound. But we will also see that probably after 9 or 10 years, we have another problem of outdated technology, and maybe we come up with a new series of satellites at a time.
In my opinion, one of the best presentations at Telecom 87 was by Cor van der Klucht. He's president of the Dutch N.V. Philips Gloeilampenfabriek. He began with a light-hearted comment.
We are talking about telecommunications. In order to make it clear to you how important this is, let me remind you that if the Emperor Napoleon had a walkie-talkie at Waterloo, you would now all speak a decent language.
And he went on to explain that in order to pay the billions of dollars needed for research into new telecommunication systems and remain viable, commercial companies and PTTs around the world are forming many alliances. In 15 years' time, if a company can't sell its high-tech communications products to about 15% of the world market, it won't be able to afford more research to continue in the race.
And although the initial changes brought about by microelectronics and information technology will be uncomfortable and require us to adapt, its long-term effects will provide vast compensation. Indeed, information technology is already the world's largest and fastest-growing market and will be the driving force for economic growth for at least the rest of this century. In the not-too-distant future, the high transmission speeds necessary for the integration of voice, text, data, image and video information will have been realized. In this way, for the next 10 to 15 years or so, the limiting factor in the realization of a telecommunication system capable of transporting all types of information will certainly not be technology. Problems that arise from the myriads of computer and telecommunication technologies will be much more of a political nature.
mind set on you.
I got my mind set on you.
I got my mind set on you.
Got my mind set on you.
But it's gonna take money, a whole lot of spending money. It's gonna take plenty of money to do it right, child.
So let's get back to shortwave, and now that the telecom's been over for 2 days, I've managed to sort out some of the media notes. First, as from this Sunday, Radio Beijing should be heard better in Europe. Transmitters of the Swiss PTT in Lenk and Saanen on 3985 and 6165 kHz respectively will be relaying programmes from China between 21 and 23 hours UTC. The Arctic Radio Club report that a new megawatt medium wave transmitter has been switched on in Afghanistan, carrying the Afghan home program on 1107 kHz. It's even being heard in Northern Europe. And yesterday at 16 hours UTC, strong shortwave test transmissions were heard in Europe from the pop music ship Radio Caroline, the frequency 6220 kHz. The power used was only 200 watts, we're told, but plans are now well advanced to broadcast many religious programmes towards Eastern Europe from the ship, using a 3.5 kilowatt shortwave transmitter they already have on board. Crystals for 9940, 6210 and 623 kHz are also on the Ross Revenge. And on the Radio Netherlands front, we've now resumed feeding our Madagascar relay station by satellite again, instead of the temporary SSB shortwave transmitter in Belgium. So here endeth the SSB Mystery Feeder Challenge. On Sunday, we make 2 frequency changes to English broadcasts, so make a note of these. At 04 hours UTC, 9895 kHz will be replaced by 9850 kHz, that's 9850, whilst for the Africa broadcast at 1830 UTC, 9540 kHz disappears, and it's being replaced by new 15180 kHz. That's 15180 kHz at 1830 UTC. Now off to one of the most professional stands at the telecom exhibition, the one from the International Amateur Radio Union. It was informative, well organised, and demonstrated that amateur radio is an important community service, not just a pastime. It was there that I met Chozo Hara, who's president of the Japan Amateur Radio League. He showed me an actual size model of the new Japanese ham radio satellite Fuji. But how could they afford to join the professionals?
First of all, we decided to build this satellite by ourselves. It works in 2 ways. First, amateurs can talk to each other by conventional speech, but we've also succeeded in creating a sort of flying electronic mailbox. A user in Europe can load a message for another amateur as the satellite flies over him. Then, some 60 minutes later, the recipient, let's say in California, can download the message from the memory on board the satellite. Most of the electronics were built by amateurs, though of course some of the outside sections of the satellite that protect the delicate circuitry from the sun's radiation were constructed professionally. We spent some 500 million yen, including some launching costs, getting the Fuji satellite into a successful orbit. We have some 760,000 amateur radio operators in Japan, and of those I'd say about 20,000 are actively using the new Japanese satellite. And, of course, the other Russian, American and European amateur satellites currently in Earth orbit. By collecting donations in Japan and abroad, we're hopeful that we can launch the next Japanese ham radio satellite within 3 years. We're fortunate that we're able to ride piggyback along with the launch of a commercial satellite, so our launch costs are minimal. But still, we've been saving money for this era for many, many years.
In other radio news, the BBC in Britain's begun test transmissions in the London area on VHF for its pop channel Radio 1. They're using a rather unusual test tape.
Hello? What are you doing up here? Hello, this is Steve Wright from Radio 1. What are you doing listening at this end of the dial? How did you find this? Now, I'll let you into a secret. Starting this Saturday, 31st of October, on this frequency, which is 104.8 megahertz, if you haven't noticed, Radio 1 will be broadcasting all its programmes in wonderful stereo FM across the London area.
Sounds novel. So were some of the brochures on the stand of the European DX Council at Telecom 87. A complaint at minister level was launched by the Chinese delegation to the ITU Secretariat. The delegation from Beijing objected to an advertisement by the Voice of Free China in the handouts produced by EDXC's Assistant Secretary General Simon Spanswick. As Taiwan isn't a member of the ITU, wasn't their objection to be expected?
It came as something of a surprise to me because the EDXC is a non-political organisation and it's here to promote shortwave listening. We don't want to get caught up in any political arguments. On reflection, it's unfortunate, perhaps, that an advert from Taiwan was included in the brochure. Had I known that this would have been the reaction, I would have taken steps to avoid it. But even so, it goes rather against the grain of promoting international cooperation and friendship, which I'm sure an event such as the World Telecoms Exhibition is supposed to do.
Well, we now change continents to catch up on media news from Asia. And if things have worked, we should have Victor Gunatilaka on the line from Sri Lanka. Victor.
Well, yes, Jonathan, as predicted last month, the clandestine Tamil Tiger Voice did not last very long. One of the first acts by the Indian forces in Jaffna on starting their offensive was to destroy the radio and television stations that the Tamil Tigers were operating for their propaganda work. This was followed by raids on their communication bases in Sri Lanka and Tamil Nadu. As a result of these raids, since the 9th of October, the clandestine broadcasts went off the air completely. At the height of its activity, there were four stations run by the different organizations. At least two were believed to be in India, while the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam maintained their TV and radio station in the heart of Jaffna. The frequency of 7010, which was used by the LTTE for the Puligulin Kural transmission, the voice of the tiger, is now being used by Radio Pakistan at 0230 UTC for a broadcast in English with dictation speed news. So people might be a little more careful and not assume that what they are hearing on 7010 is the Tamil clandestine station because it is Radio Pakistan. Well, another station in the same area, some years back this was listed as a clandestine station, and it is Azad Kashmir Radio. This was due to the disputed nature of Kashmir. This, however, is a perfectly legal station. Their first transmitter was a small 1 kilowatt unit which was located in Muzaffarabad. In recent years, it was heard on 3660 kilohertz variable, and I have a report just in from Sarath Veerakon, who has heard this frequency once again, that's 3662 kilohertz variable, around 1530 UTC until sign off at 1800. It may be that Azad Kashmir Radio has reactivated this frequency due to the northern winter when low frequencies are needed for late evening short range shortwave transmissions.
Thanks, Victor, for the update. And now we can test the ionosphere. In the Russian pavilion was a huge computer, part of whose function was a speech synthesizer. It spoke Russian and also a bit of English. Have a listen.
I like Moscow very much.
Did you understand that? It said, I like Moscow very much. Have a listen again.
I like Moscow very much.
Well, actually, we like Melbourne very much, because that's where Mike Bird is waiting to give us a survey of the last week's propagation conditions. Mike.
It's been another mixed week, Jonathan, and the solar flux has started to rise again. Solar activity has again been low, with up to 5 sunspot regions being visible. The solar flux has ranged between 89 and 107. The average works out to 80.5 and equals an effective sunspot number of 24. The geomagnetic field disturbance indicator, the A-index, has ranged between 6 and 20, which are quiet to active conditions. The field was quiet to unsettled on Thursday the 22nd. On Friday the 23rd, it became unsettled to active. And then on Saturday the 24th at 18 hours UTC, a storm started, which lasted until 14 hours UTC on Sunday the 25th. Conditions then quietened down, but another storm took place on Tuesday the 27th between 7 and 20 hours UTC. Since then, the field has been unsettled. By the way, both of these disturbances were recurrent. The ionosphere was normal until Monday the 26th, when it became depressed due to the geomagnetic disturbance. This depression lasted until yesterday, Wednesday the 28th, when it started to return to predicted levels.
And what about conditions for this coming week, then?
It doesn't look too bad, Jonathan. IPS Radio and Space Services expect that solar activity will be low. The geomagnetic field should be unsettled to active tomorrow, Friday the 30th, due to another 27-day recurrent pattern. And then hopefully the field should be unsettled for the rest of the week.
Thanks, Mike. Well, the future of these telecom exhibitions will be interesting. It's quite clear that the city of Geneva can't easily handle an event of this size. There were 70,000 guests here, but only 10,000 hotel rooms in the city. Some people are staying in hotels 3 hours' drive away. The PAL Expo has run out of space already, and prices have skyrocketed so high that one wonders whether cash rather than communications is the central issue for the host city. $250 a night in a hotel is rather making mockery of the intention to aim part of such a conference at guests from developing countries. But were the candidates that could handle a telecom more efficiently, such as Berlin, Birmingham or Amsterdam, will get the chance to bid, remains to be seen. Anyway, that's it from Geneva for now. We're back in Hilversum in 7 days' time. Have a nice weekend.
Media Network is a Radio Netherlands presentation.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.